Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khosa at 7 o'clock. We kick off this particular Thursday with yet another weird law from around the world. As I said, we're coming to the end of this particular series. We have run through a lot of weird laws and we've seemingly are running out of laws, but we do still have a couple left and we're going to see if we can get through them. This one comes to you. No surprises from the United States, but this time from the state of Nebraska. And it's particularly interesting because in the state of Nebraska, there is an interesting law that prohibits driving off of the mountain edges. So the edges of cliffs on highways and mountainous highways, driving off of the edges of those cliffs is prohibited in the state of Nebraska. Now, what is interesting about it is not that that law is in place. It is the fact that the state of Nebraska is largely a flat state with no actual mountains. A prime example of a time where laws were borrowed from a different jurisdiction and not really amended to be fit for purpose. Weird laws. They're there, but we're going to keep finding them. You're tuning into the SFM Market Update with Money Web. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the findings of the tax ombud where it relates to e-profile hijackings and how that needs to be addressed. We're going to speak to the office of the tax ombud around that and get a sense of what that investigation entailed and what it means for consumers. We've also got a conversation with the founder of WineX in celebration of 25 years of WineX this year. We know that Standard Bank is a lead sponsor for WineX, so we're going to be speaking to them in the context of that partnership and that relationship. We're going to get a sense of what to expect from WineX this year from the founder of the business and how the business has transformed, or how the event rather has transformed over the more than 25 years it has been in existence. We've also got a conversation with South African breweries on the heritage of beer. In particular, we're going to be looking at the brewery that is in Newlands in the Western Cape. It is not only the oldest brewery in South Africa, it is the oldest brewery on the African continent, and in fact is older than SAB itself. So we're going to speak to the director or the brewery director of that particular brewery and get a sense of the heritage behind that and the heritage behind the beer that has been produced by that brewery. And then because it's Thursday, we've got a small business conversation to get into. We're going to spotlight another small business in the form of Stitches Uniforms. We're going to speak to the founder of the business, Teboho Moluzi, and get a sense of how she built that business, why she built the business, and what the business does today.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we start off the show with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It is only the second day of October, and already we are seeing some interesting market movements. To take a look at these market movements, I'm joined on the line by founder and good friend, founder Just One Lap and good friend Simon Brown, to see what we make of some of the movements throughout the day. Si, thanks so much for taking the time. Always lovely having you on the show. We kicked off the month in banger territory. New all-time highs on the JSE, new all-time highs on the top 40. We were making record levels across the board. Today was a red day, but looking at how red it was, I can't help but wonder if it was a bit of a mixture of, yes, weaker resource pricing, but maybe some profit taking coming to the market. What did you make of today's movements?
Even Jimmy, I think you're right. I mean, if we look at the market, we were actually having a fairly good day. And then what, at about 3 o'clock, we took a leg down. And then sort of about 4 o'clock, we suddenly turned red. And I think it was, you talk around profit taking. We saw the PGM prices under pressure overnight. That continued through the day, platinum and palladium. They're still at good levels. But if we look at the big losers in the top 40, it's Sibanye, it's Forterra, it's Implat, it's Northam, off all of those, platinum, and then Capitec. And I think Capitec just after the excellent results and run of yesterday. So I do think it's you know, rather than anything to majorly worry about, it is that we've seen those PGMs run hard. We saw the pullback, and I think some folks were like, you know what, nothing wrong with taking some profits at these points, because the PGM counters really have had a very good, 3, 4, 5 months as the metal moved higher.
So the rand's also gotten a little bit weaker, around 17.30 odd against the US dollar. I'm looking at the Dixie, the dollar index, the basket of currencies that the dollar is measured against, and that seems to be on the up in the case of the dollar strengthening a bit there. We are still in a US shutdown. What is the latest out of Washington, and what seems to be driving some dollar positivity at the moment?
So the latest out of Washington, as best I can tell, is that nothing is happening. The Democrats are insisting that the Republicans make some proposals that they can talk about, and the Republicans are saying no dice, not interested. And they need the 60 votes in the Senate. They've got 51, 52. They do need to get some Democratic support, but by all accounts, there is no conversations happening at all. And I think that is kind of slightly spooking the world. U.S. shutdowns are not uncommon. The longest ever was 34 days. That was back. It was 2018 under Trump's first term. This does look like it's going to drag on, but typically they get fairly quickly resolved. They look ugly and then suddenly something happens. Importantly, there is an immediate hit to the US economy, but it usually recoups. And a lot of the furloughed workers don't get paid, but then get back pay. So it's kind of like a hit now, but then it sort of recoups it down the line. But it has got global markets, which are at elevated levels, to be clear, a little bit spooked. And certainly we've seen dollar strength against the euro. That's resulted in weakness of our rand. It was, about 17.18 at one point this morning. As you mentioned, 17.30 at this point. There's also, as the rand sort of takes those new legs lower and strengthens, we do see, I think, a lot of currency flows that sort of reverse that direction for the short while as people take opportunity of that rand strength.
So let's quickly look at the jobs numbers out of the US. We got ADP numbers yesterday, which effectively gives us a sense of the private jobs report, not so much the non-farms numbers that are set to come out tomorrow. ADP numbers, big miss, and we had to revise down the previous read into negative territory. Should we be worried about the jobs data that's going to come out of the US tomorrow? And is the market pricing that into the dollar?
Yeah, I mean, we should be worried. I mean, there's a couple of points that are important. ADP is payroll data. So it's as opposed to the normal jobs data from the Bureau of Labor. The Bureau of Labor is survey data. That's why you get large revisions. You get most of the surveys, about 65, 70% done in the first month. That will be coming out tomorrow. And then there's a lag. Some comes month two, some then only ultimately comes month three. But it's not direct payroll data. So ADP is often considered to be a better benchmark, although it doesn't, of course, include any government or federal workers. It is, as you said, private. I don't know. I mean, the federal government's shut down. So, I mean, do we get data tomorrow? The short answer is we do, I suppose, because not everyone gets furloughed. And the quality, let's assume it's good. But it is, and this goes back to Jerome Powell at Jackson Hole in August, and you and I have chatted about this. Essentially, he pivoted and said, you know what, inflation's rising, and that's not great. Our target is 2%, and it's bumping around 3%. But he's worried about jobs. And I think that is his focus. And we haven't had a lot of data since then. We've had two ADPs now and one from the Bureau of Labor Survey. They've all been poor. They've all been uninspiring numbers whatsoever. Interestingly, unemployment is remaining low, 4.3. That's not expected to change, but that's probably been driven by immigration policy. So the market is watching tomorrow's data point very closely, because the market is equally pricing in about an 80%+ chance of a rate cut later in October and about a 65% rate cut from the FOMC in December. And if we don't, you know, if the jobs data suddenly comes strong, those rate cuts are off the table, and the market really wants that. So the number is important, but ironically, the market might actually like a weaker number, because it makes the likelihood of two more rate cuts this year much stronger.
So I want to take a look at Naspers in two parts. First of all, the acquisition of that Just Eat business in the Netherlands. We're finally over 90% of the shares committed to that. So that deal is going to go ahead unconditionally. I want to get your thoughts around that. But let's start with the fact that if somebody had opened up their Naspers chart this morning or even their stock portfolio yesterday, they would have had the share price trading above 6,000 Rand a share. Today, it closed at 1,200 or just under 1,300 Rand a share. That causes panic, except if you know, of course, that there was a stock split.
There was a stock split. So let's say you had 10 Naspers shares when you went to bed last week and they were 6,000 Rand each. That was 60,000 Rand. The split means that instead of 10 shares, you've now got 50 shares, but your quantity went up fivefold, price went down 80%. So effectively, you're in exactly the same place. You've just got a larger number of shares, and the price is down a whole lot. This really is semantics. It doesn't change the value of the company. It doesn't change the profitability. The logic behind it is that for smaller shareholders, 6,000 Rand is a lot to lay out for one share. And now, of course, you could buy one share with 1,200. Fractional shares make that moot, but there's only really one broker offering the fractional shares on our market. So that does offer opportunity to some smaller investors. The Just Eat takeaway.com, it's an interesting deal. I mean, there are a couple of things. Naspers and Process is, of course, still all about Tencent. And the plan is to try and, you know, get some other businesses that will sort of can stack up against Tencent. That is a giant ask. But they really are doubling down on online classifieds and food delivery. And I have to say, I'm skeptical about food delivery because I think about my own situation. I've got a couple of apps on my phone, and I'm not loyal to any of them. There's attempts at gamification, but you know, to me, it's about what is the food and what is the price, and that's the app that wins. But there's a flip side to it, which what's happened in markets was that sort of land grab where, you know, you did great discount deals, you did great deals with the restaurants, and you've only got one or two left standing. And a lot of other attempts at it, other startups sort of fall away. And if we look at Europe, at one point there were over 25 different food deliveries. And across the continent, that number has whittled its way down to about half a dozen, which does mean that, yes, I might not be loyal to one app, but I've only got a few choices, so I'm going to hit one or the other. And Naspers has been strategically positioned this. They've exited, I think it was Brazilian food delivery operations that they had. They've been very much focusing down and targeting a few different niches, and food delivery is definitely one of them. One of the ironies, of course, is that they tried to buy, was it Just Eat, and Takeaway.com swooped in and bought it, and then they bought both of them. So they really are sort of, and that's the process where there is that either some close down, you get amalgamations, and you end up with only a few players, and that then starts to give them some pricing power in the space.
It's an 83 billion Rand deal, or around 4.1 billion euros, now that we have some numbers to put to it. Si, do you think this is enough? In the past, I know you and I have spoken about that almost elephant conversation around Naspers, to say they've been chasing another unicorn since the Tencent unicorn that they were able to get into. Some of the business deals have worked, some of them haven't. Is this one that you think could work for the group?
I think it can. Is this another Tencent? And the answer is no. I mean, they are just, I mean, it is deeply unlikely that we see another Tencent deal. I mean, this was a $36 million investment that they did, and the current holding is probably about 2 trillion. I mean, it's just absolutely staggering. And the 2 trillion number is actually not quite correct because they've been selling down the Tencent holding. But nonetheless, it is not a sort of deal that I think most people never do that sort of deal. I don't think you get to do it twice. And I don't think the market is looking for them to do it twice. I think the market is saying, look, you're selling down your Tencent stake and using that money to buy back your own shares in Naspers and Process. And some of that money you then using, as you said, the 4 billion odd going into this current transaction. And that in time, assuming that they do some good deals outside of the Tencent stable, that in time sort of starts to correct that balance. but it's still a long way to go. You know, 4 billion for you and me and the listeners out there is a big number. In the life of NASPAS, it is really, really rounding errors, but they're moving in the right direction. They've been fairly aggressive with their portfolio this year. They've had some listings that have really helped them. One in India, they've had some exits, as I said. They're becoming a lot more strategic. And these sort of deals, as I said, does sort of raise the non-10-cent part of the business. But NASPAS and Prosus, unless they sell down or unbundle the stake entirely, they're always going to be a 10-cent story more than anything else.
Well, we'll have to see how they continue that unbundling process and see how they continue the value unlock that they have been desperately aiming to do for the last number of years. For now, I suppose we celebrate the deal that is on the table. We celebrate the fact that the Rand is still holding its own and the fact that the All Share Index is still trading above 100,000 points despite having a negative day. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Simon for those insights and for the time. Simon Brown, founder at Just One Lap, joining us to take a look at market movements, some data points, as well as some interesting sends announcements that we got from our local counters.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, the Office of the Tax Ombud had been investigating the e-filing profiles being hijacked, or the hijacking rather of e-filing profiles of taxpayers, and they were set to release a draft report around some of their findings back in July, with a final report that was supposed to be expected around August. We didn't get that. We had to push back some of those dates, but we do finally have an update from the Office of the Tax Ombud relating to this, and we're going to take a look at it and see what we make of it. I'm joined on the line by the acting CEO of the Office of the Tax Ombud, that is Mamelau Malakalaka, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Mamelau, thanks so much for taking the time. Let's perhaps start with a bit of an overview around what it is that the Tax Ombud was looking into here specifically.
Thank you, Jimmy, and thank you for having us. The Office of Tax Ombud, we're looking at how profiles get hijacked by fraudsters. So you would get a fraudster that comes in and takes over your e-file profile and makes fraudulent tax returns, and in turn changes their bank account. And if there's a refund, it gets redirected into their bank account. So we're looking into how do these fraudsters get hold of your e-file profile, and what are the securities surrounding that within SARS.
Mamelau, what were you able to uncover in terms of what you looked into? I know there were some areas of concern. There were some areas that the South African Revenue Services asked to respond to. Give us some insights around what it is you were able to uncover.
I think one of the biggest things that when we started off from the taxpayers, it was the fact that the one-time PIN, the two-factor authenticator, was optional. So that was fixed by SARS in November 2024. And after that was fixed, I think most of the enhancements that SARS did made it better not easy for fraudsters to get in. The other parts that were really, really a thorn for the taxpayers was with regards to the fact that it takes long for these investigations to be finalized. So for SARS to finalize the investigation sometimes takes over a year. And in that year, you don't have access to your e-file profile. And some taxpayers, especially companies, are unable to file their VAT returns. So that was the biggest problem about these e-file profile hijacking reports. We have found out that they are valid. in terms of, yes, it takes long for the investigation. I think SARS gave us a date of about 150 days. And when we looked at their data, it took about almost a year for some of them. And when we looked at also their data for 2024, we found out that 94% of the cases finalized were found in favor of the taxpayer. So which means that now the fraudster has left with the money. Now they have to reimburse the taxpayer of the money that was stolen for a due refund. If you had a refund due and the taxpayer and the fraudster had changed the bank account and took the money, now SARS has to reimburse you the money that the fraudster had taken.
Mamela, the draft document that you have put together around this, obviously at this stage there's a lot that can be done, and we know that from the perspective of the South African Revenue Services, they've been putting in place measures to try and mitigate these sorts of incidents. Can you give us a sense of perhaps where we go to from here, what it means for taxpayers if they are to still be the victims of these sorts of incidents? We know that the incident rate has potentially come down since you launched the investigation, but we'd rather have it at zero than sit where it is. What can we expect taxpayers to make of what's contained in the report?
Yes, I think it has come down, but as you know, that if every fraudster, every change in the system would trigger the fraudster to learn the new ways of actually getting into the system again. And what we want the taxpayer to actually think of SARS as a bank, because your banking details, you wouldn't necessarily give them to everybody. So don't give your SARS details to anybody. We urge them to actually be vigilant in terms of how they use their SARS information. And if you need somebody to help you, because you have a right to have a tax representative assist you, find out if they are registered tax practitioner. You can find out that on the SARS website. And you can also find out if they are affiliated to any recognized controlling body like SAICA, SAIPA, or SAID. So those are the things that we want taxpayers to be aware of, that, you know, your SARS details are linked to your banking details, and think of SARS as a bank, that you wouldn't necessarily just give everybody your banking details and your banking pins and everything. So be vigilant about your SARS details and keep them safe. And another thing that we want to actually caution the taxpayers about is also just accepting any representation from a tax practitioner. We want to say to them, when you have to have people represent you or people assist you with your taxes, make sure that they are registered as a registered tax practitioner. Make sure that they're affiliated with the controlling body. Those are the things that will help you going forward. But with regards to also SARS measures that they're putting in place, being the biometrics going forward, they have biometrics now that they've introduced, and also the two-factor authentication. Taxpayers must also make use of those. If they are not working or they are not in use, or they don't know how to use them, it's best to actually contact us or contact us for assistance to say, how do we best make sure that your information is protected, and where to go when it's not working.
It's important to protect your information and prevent hackers from finding out your details, even if it is for your e-filing profile. Treat that as the same way you would treat your bank account. That is the message from the Office of the Tax Ombud, following an investigation they'd conducted into what had been happening with e-filing profiles being hijacked. Thank you so much to the acting CEO of the Office of the Tax Ombud, Mamela Malakalaka, for joining us and giving us a sense of what it is that South Africans can do to protect themselves.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. We have kicked off the month of October, and whilst there are a few things we are looking forward to in this month and the next, something that is coming up at the very end of the month of October is a very special event that has been going on for a little over 25 years in its current form and 50 years in its truest form. I'm of course referring to Winex, that takes place in the final couple of days of October. And to take a look at this, I'm joined in studio by none other than the founder of of Winex, Michael Frigeron, to take a look at the event and see what we can expect this year. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for coming to studio to chat to us about this. Let's give our listeners an overview of why you started Winex. It's got a rich history to it, and I think that history needs to be shared.
Well, Winex in its current iteration dates back to 2000, and it emerged from what had in its original form been the Rand Daily Mail Wine Festival. When the Rand Daily Mail folded, it became the Business Day Wine Festival. And because I was and still am the wine writer for Business Day, I was certainly part of all the thinking and planning around the show when it was the Business Day Wine Festival. In fact, which is a terrible confession of age, in my very first job, in my very first moment of being formally employed in the wine industry, I landed up at the very first Rand Daily Mail Wine Festival. We got the job of hosting a wine festival at a venue which in those days was called the Courthouse. It was a magnificent mansion in Sandhurst. And there had been a sale of the property and a gap of 3 or 6 months before the new owner moved in. And we were given the pool house and surrounds to organize a wine festival. In retrospect, that was about as stupid an idea as anyone could come up with. To have a wine festival next to a very large swimming pool was a recipe for disaster. We had a fabulous time because we were standing behind the stands, but a lot of people seemed to have gone home very wet. And the one bit of trouble I did get into is we noticed that the roof of the pool house had a kind of paper mache ceiling. And if you popped a champagne cork into it, the cork stuck in the ceiling. So we popped lots of corks into the ceiling and thought it was very funny till we got the bill to repair the ceiling, which wasn't nearly as much fun. So I really have been involved from the outset. And what I saw from in the days certainly of the Business Day Festival is that people were hungry for an opportunity to come and to taste as many wines as they could, to formulate and to, I suppose, crystallize their own preferences. So very well to say, well, I prefer wooded Chardonnay to an unwooded Chardonnay, but you don't often have an opportunity of putting one next to the other and actually arriving at a conclusion. And taste memory is elusive. You think you remember what that bottle tasted like, but, you know, three stands away, it's not so clear. So when you go to Winex, there are somewhere between 130 and 150 different wineries. That really represents a sizable chunk of the total production of fine wine in the Cape at a bigger than very tiny boutique stage. You know, if you're making wine in your garage, you're not big enough to warrant having to go from the Cape to Johannesburg to talk to what is actually the largest market in the world for Cape wine. So you don't, but everyone else has to. Gauteng accounts for more wine, Cape wine, sold than the whole of the UK, more than North America. We are really where the Cape producers sell their wine. And so they come to Winex, and as a consumer, you have that opportunity to sample your way across the board endlessly if you pay attention to a few sensible rules, like not swallowing everything you sample.
Michael, it's very clear that South African consumers have a love for their wines, but it's equally clear that South African producers have a passion for what they produce, and they're not afraid to showcase their excellence. Take us perhaps through what that now looks like, 25 years into an event like Winex, where every single year producers have that opportunity to come and showcase the very best of what it is they're able to grow and produce and harvest, and what that does for the wine industry in South Africa, especially given that we're a wine exporting country.
So you've really touched on a very important point. If you go back to pre-1994, we probably had 200 wineries in the Cape, and most of them were large cooperative cellars. The producers there literally chucked all the grapes from any number of producers, growers, into the press at the same time to produce dry white wine, to produce bulk Chenin Blanc, bulk column bar, bulk pinotage, and then the big producing wholesalers would come along and buy bulk from these huge sellers and brand it and sell it under their own brand labels. And that situation prevailed through pretty much to the beginning of the Winex era in 2000. By then, the industry was really getting sharper and better at what it was doing, and a whole new generation of winemakers had suddenly discovered the international market. So with the end of isolation, there was more opportunity for young winemakers and more opportunity for people who were passionate about what they were doing, as opposed to those guys who think, well, it's a job like anything else. And the more you work in some of those really big co-op type cellars, the more you really are a corporate winemaker. But the moment you are dealing with the estate wine, the moment you are dealing with the connection between where the grapes are grown, where they are processed in your winery, how long you keep them in barrel, how long you keep them in bottle, when you release them, what decisions you make every year about the label, because the more passionate you are, the more you want that label to be the story of your particular year of that harvest. Suddenly you've got this influx of new producers, and what they did is that they stimulated the older guys, the bigger guys, even the more commercial, the more industrial wineries. Suddenly they all realized that wine wasn't just a job. It was there because you loved what you did. And so we now have an industry which the international critics describe as the most exciting in the world. And that's a function of the passion of the winemakers, of the focus that they have invested in the single sites, the tiny blocks, many of them are very old vines, and get from those blocks something that is an expression of place, unique for that time, that year, that harvest, that producer. It's actually very exciting to be witness to it.
Michael, speaking of invested passion, take me through the partnership with Standard Bank. Winex has had many a partner over the years, and at this stage, in the 25th edition of Winex, Standard Bank Private is the chosen partner for this particular iteration of the event. But I can imagine that when you've curated such a very special event, a lot of thought goes into how you identify your partnerships and how that alignment will then be sort of presented towards the consumers and the producers.
Well, firstly, we haven't had many partners over the years. As Winex, Standard Bank is only the second partner in that 25 years of history. We are, as you rightly say, very careful. There has to be a fit, and that fit is emotional. Obviously, there's a financial component, but that emotional fit is very important. And you need to ask yourself, what is in it for the bank? You can say, well, Winex is great. We get the bank. We get, you know, the bank's money. It's not like that. It works both ways. For us, we love the passion that Standard Bank brings to Winex. And they bring that passion there because I think they understand that wine is not a grocery commodity. Wine is something that touches your very core. It is very personal. The late Anton Rupert said that anything that you put into your mouth requires a very special kind of marketing. And when it comes to wine, it also involves one's perception of self. And when you are successful, when you arrive at the point where you can be a client of Standard Bank Private, that's a celebratory moment. And wine is exactly the product that connects that celebration and then travels with you along the voyage of your success. And that's also worth considering. Wine is not an instant beverage. You buy it, you keep it, your tastes evolve. The person that you are obviously changes over the course of your life. And you want to know that you are partnered both in wine and obviously with your bank, with a partner that travels that path with you. Wine does it because your tastes change, and wine does it because even when your tastes don't change, it changes in the bottle. And that flexibility, that ability to give and take, is built into wine and built into the relationship with Standard Bank Private.
It's all about finding that perfect pairing, and that's exactly what you can do between the 29th and the 31st of October this year. If you are looking to attend WineX, it will obviously be taking place at the Sandton Convention Centre, where it has famously been taking place for the last number of years. We'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Michael for joining me in studio to take a look at WineX. That was Michael Frejon, the founder of WineX, joining us to take a look at a historic milestone in the history of one of the most successful, if not the most successful, wine events in South Africa. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by SAB, 130 years of being committed to South Africa. As we concluded Heritage Month last month, we have been celebrating some of the rich heritage that South Africa has to offer, and part of that has included the 130-year heritage of South African breweries. We're going to be taking a look at the special heritage that SAB has brought to the country and to the world over the last 130 years. Joined on the line by the brewery director for SAB, Kyle Moskowitz, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Kyle, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. What does a brewery director do? What does a day in your life look like?
Thank you very much, Jimmy, and it's a pleasure to be here and talk to you about the heritage of SAB. So essentially, I'm responsible for the day-to-day operations of the whole entity of Newlands Brewery located in Cape Town. So essentially, it always starts with safety, either leading the brewery-wide safety meeting or attending one of the departmental meetings like brewing, utilities, packaging, logistics, or quality to ensure we are always clear that safety is first. And then this typically includes a review of the past 24 hours safety statistics and a form of training or agreed actions to be better than yesterday. Once we have set the tone for a safe day, it's time to review our production statistics over the last 24 hours. Essentially, I spend time with my team to determine what went well and where are our opportunities for us to meet our production plans for the day, all in the pursuit to quench the thirst of our customers. Using the information consolidated for the day, I'll also spend time walking the brewery. I'll go to the various departments to try to help understand the challenges and ask where I can support the teams. And this is quite a fun time because this is now reviewing around the 600 employees, including our temporary staff, to be aligned and focused to safely produce our brands. Around midday, a little bit more around our week view of what we're trying to produce and verification of the quality. And then really making sure we're able to meet the various commitments we have. And if it's a good day, I'll be able to make my way to the taste room and join our sensory panel, a select group of trained tasters, to either sample the previous day production for quality control or conduct a deeper brand profile analysis on what we produced to determine if we are not only meeting the consumer standards, but exceeding our own high expectations. In the afternoon, like almost any other job or role, will be a combination of meetings as well as reviewing of performance related to safety, quality, cost, or volume. And then if it's been a really good day, especially towards the end, a visit to the work pub afterwards for a delicious draft beer.
Now, Kyle, I stand to be corrected, but isn't this particular brewery older than SAB itself? Isn't this a 205-year-old brewery that you are responsible for?
100%. So essentially, the Newlands Brewery has been built around and incorporates the original Mariendal Brewery that was founded in 1820 and was part of the consolidated breweries after 1895, particularly around 1956, where SAB, Olsen's Cape Breweries, and United Brewers merged to create SAB Limited. So it really is steeped in heritage, not only because of our location under the beautiful Table Mountain, but because of why the brewery was built here in the first place including the fact that we still have the heritage building, the old Mariendale Brewery, the shell of it, as well as some key brewing equipment located throughout the building itself.
And folks, I've just confirmed, given that we are taking a look at heritage, this is officially the oldest brewery in South Africa, probably the oldest on the African continent. I'm just checking on that as well. But while I do that, Kyle, perhaps you can tell us about the unique features of the brewery over the years and what having such a rich heritage and a rich history in a brewery has allowed for the SAB team to do in terms of their production and in terms of the beer that you're able to produce there.
Absolutely love that question, particularly because it is something that we hold near and dear to our hearts. So essentially with this brewery that was created in 1820, the reason it was selected for the site is because one of the things you need to be able to produce amazing beer consistently is the quality of water. So we are very lucky to have a reliable water source known as Newland Spring, which is essentially fed from the foot of Table Mountain and is what we are using not just only at the main Newlands Brewery, but also our smaller craft brewery, Newland Spring Brewing Company, to produce all our beers. Because of this, we have very consistent water quality, very high water quality that goes into every beer. And that's definitely one of the main unique characteristics. Keeping in mind, as I mentioned before, the old Mariendale Brewery still exists. So there's some of the old gravity-fed brew house, essentially four stories up in this tower where the equipment started, where the mold, malt, and grist would have been mixed and then transferred lower down into a water tank for separation, further down into a kettle, and further down into separation, because essentially there weren't really pumps available back in the 1820s. So you would use the pressure from the spring to feed up into the top of the brew house and allow gravity to do the work. And then probably one of the next unique aspects is that because we still have quite a bit of that space within the old brewery, we built a 20-hectoliter craft brewery within the walls of the Mariendale Brewery called Newland Spring Brewing Company, which provides a variety of not just lagers, but different varieties like Weiss beer and pale ales. Because of this, we also open ourselves up to the public. We have the opportunity for people to come actually explore this with us, and they can book a tour to not only come walk through the main plant to see how things have changed between 1820 and 2025, but then also to go tour the old building and ends up with a fantastic tasting session afterwards to see the different styles of the new and the old beer.
Kyle, I'm glad you brought up the different varieties and the different products you're able to produce within the brewery. As the brewing director, you're pretty much the only person I can ask this to. What's your favorite beer? Who's your favorite child?
Who's my favorite child? I love the analogy. It's such a tough question because no matter where or the occasion, there's always a beer for it. However, putting me on the spot, while I believe that all our beers have a perfect time and place, if I really had to choose, it would be Castle Lager. It really is the brewer's beer. It's got a relatively complex recipe combining our local malt and local hops sourced from our amazing farmers in South Africa, a very crisp fermentation, and we expertly package it here to ensure we seal in the quality. And it's frankly delicious because it's the reason it is the taste that stood the test of time.
A beer that has been brewed since just before the 1900s. The Castle Lager beer is still a favorite amongst South Africans, even those that work within the SAB family. I think that speaks to the heritage of South African breweries over the last 130 years, the heritage of the Newlands Brewery over the last 205 years, and the heritage of Castle Lager as a brand. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Kyle for those insights and for the time. Lovely having you on the show, Kyle. Kyle Moskowitz, the brewery director at SAB, joining us to take a look at heritage within the beer industry. This interview was brought to you by SAB. 130 years of being committed to South Africa.
Commitment is not just brewing beer. It's brewing hope. It's brewing dreams.
It's brewing a legacy. For over a century, believing in something bigger. Commitment is brewing a promise to step up when the nation calls, to brew moments that matter, that bring us together. For you, for the next generation, for 130 years and forever. SAB, forever committed to a future with more cheers.
South Africa, be sharp, not for persons under the age of 18.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It's SME time on a Thursday. We love getting to speak to small businesses doing exceptionally well for themselves. Just hopefully we can help them do a little bit better. This week's small business is a company called Stitches Uniforms, a company founded by a lady named Taboho Mulutsi, who joins me on the line now to tell us more about her business and what it is that they do. Taboho, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. How does a young lady from Rustenburg build a uniform business? Tell us about this business.
Hi, Jimmy. Firstly, thank you so much for having me. So, yes, my name is Taboho Mulutsi. I am founder of Stitches Uniform, which is a uniform manufacturer based in Rustenburg. So, you know, coming from, I come from a mining community, you know, Kopukeng in Rustenburg. You know, Rustenburg is known as the Platinum City because of the many platinum mines that are in Rustenburg. So I started this business with my mother at a time when there weren't any manufacturing factories at the time in Rustenburg. And, you know, for me and my mother, that felt so wrong. So we built a factory to service the mines with protective clothing.
Taboho, tell me about what it is that you provide today. I see the website has got the protective clothing that you mentioned. I see you also do school uniforms. I see you do security uniforms as well. Tell me about everything that the business has to offer and how it is that you got to grow the business the way you did.
Okay, so school uniform is currently, at this moment, our biggest product. But we also provide to different industries. You know, we do protective clothing for the mines and constructions. We do a uniform for combat, you know, securities, as well as for hospitality. And then we also do branding services in the form of embroidery and dye sublimation.
Taboho, you've been running this business for 14 years. That means you've run this business through the pandemic and come out of the pandemic on the other side. What was that like for you? What were some of the challenges you've had to face with this business? And how did you not give up and continue to grow the business?
Well, you know, Jimmy, as I'm sure you know, running a business is not easy. I started the business, like I had mentioned, with my mother. And, you know, we had 48 industrial sewing machines. We were employing 25 women from local communities. But, you know, starting and maintaining a business is not easy. We were faced with a number of challenges, from limited resources to a fierce market competition. And, you know, somewhere my mother also got sick and she died. So within 4 years of opening that business, I was forced to close doors, you know, because I couldn't keep up anymore. But it was at that time also I realized that, you know, I'm an entrepreneur through and through. I've got resilience stitched in my DNA because, you know, it was at that time that I sat down and regrouped and relooked at my business plan. And then in 2020, actually, when the country was still under the grip of COVID-19, I opened my first store in the bustling CBD of Rustenburg. And that was followed shortly by a second one in Lekgalong, which is a township on the outskirts of Rustenburg. And then a third one in Pukeng, a rural village. And then a fourth one, we're currently sitting on 5 stores because we realized that, I realized that, you know, parents, especially from rural areas, more especially, you know, remote areas, during busy seasons like back to school and winter season, has to always travel into town to source a uniform. You know, then they have to stand on long queues and buy very expensive uniforms. So by taking my products to the people, you know, I am meeting them halfway.
Taboho, take me through your manufacturing process. You mentioned that you had manufacturing facilities back when you first opened the business, but I also understand that you have a background in manufacturing from a professional point of view. Take me through what your operation looks like today and how you're able to supply those five stores that you have.
So we currently have over 60 industrial sewing machines. We are staffed with 22 employees, so 16 permanent and 8 casuals. And then we have a 6-head embroidery machine, a single-head embroidery machine. We also have a sublimation machine. So we currently still outsource our material. Our goal is to grow to a point where, you know, we also manufacture our own fabric in a way, you know, lock in the value chain as where we manufacture our own fabric and then retail directly to our end users.
I love that you're thinking along those lines, Tebogo, saying that you want to own more of your value chain and you want to pass that on to your consumers. So how can people get hold of Stitches Uniforms? How do people interact with the business? Give us your website details, your social media platforms, all of the information where people can go and find Stitches Uniforms.
So our website is www.stitchesuniforms.co.za. We are also on Facebook as Stitches Uniforms, the same name on Instagram, Stitches Uniforms. So our business WhatsApp line is 066-506-7669.
So Tebogo, what's next for the business? You mentioned that you want to continue expanding the business, growing the business. What do you want to see happen to the business and where do you want the business to end up?
Okay, so we have just currently acquired a piece of land which we want to develop into a factory that will allow us, you know, to set up proper lines and, you know, do training as well, offer training to the youth because, you know, at this stage in South Africa, sewing is a dying trade. So we want to give back to the community by offering sewing training. We also, you know, want to take Stitches Uniform beyond the borders of Rustenburg. We want to open more stores across South Africa and beyond.
A resilient business that has come back from despair to grow into an enterprise that creates jobs and provides skills to its community. This is the kind of small business that everybody would want to see succeed. And by everybody, I include us at the SAFM team. We wish you all of the very best of luck with the business, Tebogo. Keep us updated on your successes. All the very best to you and to your team. We'll leave the conversation on that note. That was Tebogo Mulutsi, who is the founder of Stitches Uniforms, joining us to take a look at her small business, how she built it, and where she intends to take it. For more details about the business, for those that missed those details, it is Stitches Uniforms, one word, nothing in between, .co.za. Go give them a shout, go check them out, and be sure to buy your uniforms from them. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
That's the sound of your business growing. Whether you're starting out or scaling up, turn your passion into profit with Capitec Business Banking. Save up to 50% on fees. Get fast credit approvals, personalized support, and Forex for your business. Open your business banking account on our app. Bank on better with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, 46669. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the show for today, folks. That's the show for the week. We'll be keeping an eye out on what's happening in the United States and giving you updates around that as well. Hopefully, we do get some data out of the US tomorrow and markets are still digesting what is happening there. But if there is nothing to update from that perspective, we'll keep an eye on it going into the weekend and see what Monday brings. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means we're going to get ready to cross over to Greg Khos for the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Dumin Khapele. She'll be standing in for Michael Abramson on the Top Sport show. So that's what's coming up now, which means from my side, good night.